Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Shift Extension Podcast. I'm Nick, and today, Sonny and I sit down with a very special guest, Mr. Darren Hodge. Darren is a flight MICA paramedic from Ambulance Victoria down in Melbourne. Darren has joined us today to share one of the most challenging jobs of his career. Now, this story isn't just about what happened during the job, but what happened after. It's one of many stories in Darren's book, Life on the Line. This is an incredible book about a paramedic's career in Australia. So we're very fortunate to have Darren on today. So let's get into it. Darren, thank you so much for coming on and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So I got Darren on. Darren's the author of a fantastic book. It's great to have two authors on today. We've also got Sonny back as well. But tell us about your book and what inspired you to write it.
So the book, I launched the book just preceding the pandemic. So if anyone's going to launch a book, that's not a time to launch a book. Where did it come from? There's probably a few reasons why I decided to write the book. The main one would be sort of, I guess, based around some mental health stuff. So in 2005, I was involved in the second Bali bombing, and my wife and I were going over there to get married. And she's a nurse, I'm a paramedic. We decided to go down to see if we could help. We got involved with an Australian gentleman who was over there holidaying with his son and daughter. He was critically injured. His daughter also received large percentage burns, and very sadly, his son, Brendan, who was 16 at the time, was killed in the blast.
Wow.
And, you know, through the course of going into the hospital in Denpasar, and, you know, it was made clear we could only look after Australians. We'd sort of searched for Australians, and we were taken throughout the hospital. We found ourselves in the morgue. And as soon as we entered, we were pushed to the side and we had to stay there while they did a press conference from the morgue.
Wow.
Despite being a paramedic for 25 years at the time, I think that's one of the most distressing things I've ever seen in my life. And there's no censorship on media in Indonesia. They just filmed everything and it was really terrible. From there, we sort of went and met Terry Fitzgerald and his daughter Jessica, and Julie looked after Jessica and I looked after Terry for, I actually don't remember, really know how long it was, 8 or 9 hours, but we found ourselves caring for them in that time. And it was a really terrible thing to witness. We saw there's several people died around us while we were caring for them. Terry had been really badly treated. He'd been mismanaged, and we were given complete care of Terry and Jessica from the moment we walked in, which was very weird. But ultimately Terry survived, and as did Jessica, and wow. They decided to write a tribute book to Brendan, who was killed, as I said. And they asked all the people that had been involved in the chain of their survival to write a chapter, and there'd been quite a few people. I was very troubled by the Bali experience, and I found when I wrote about that story, I found it really quite cathartic, and it was really a powerful thing. And I sort of learnt a reasonable lesson about how to manage my mental health. And it wasn't until I was working on the ambulance helicopter a few years later, and I was involved in a case where we performed an infield surgical amputation on a young man who was involved in a truck crash. And It was a very strange job, not typical. In Victoria Ambulance's history, it was the first time we'd done a surgical amputation in a motor vehicle accident. We've done one since, I beg your pardon, involving a train accident. But it was unusual. It was in a very political time. We had a group of doctors lobbying very heavily to get onto the ambulance helicopter.
Mm.
Some of them chose to make this a political discussion and made some suggestions about my management and my actions. I had some criticism from internal with inside the ambulance service. And it got very, very messy, and it got to a point where I actually couldn't work anymore. And,
wow.
It was probably one of the worst experiences. I've been divorced before. My first wife decided she had a thing for firemen rather than paramedics, and I was obviously devastated at that time. But I think this was the worst experience of my life. It was wow. just deeply devastating.
Aaron, when you speak about it being one of the worst experiences of your life, and I mean, look, I draw from my own military experience and then ambulance service as well, but from what you're just saying, it doesn't sound as though the actual incident was the worst experience of your life. It almost sounds as though it was the treatment of you afterwards, or the lack of what sounds like support after the infield amputation. Have I got that right, or have I gone off on the wrong path?
No, it's funny. It's interesting. I didn't understand that at the time. I thought it was very much around that the action and the act, and I thought that was the thing that was troubling to me the most. But it's not until I got professional help that was pointed out to me. And what is so deeply upsetting to me was the fact that I felt abandoned by my organisation. And, it was a very complex case. You know, we arrived at the scene, typical, just a truck's gone off the road, nothing unusual there. Hmm. We get told to bring our harnesses. Never had to take a harness to do a rescue like that. So why? Train's challenging. Then I get picked up by the scene commander, who's the senior clinician, and I thought, why would he be leaving the scene to come and get me? And he said, oh, look, the scene's broken. He said, there's a lot of conflict. The paramedics have assessed the scene and decided that it's not safe. There's a member of one of the volunteer organisations that doesn't agree with this, and there's conflict. And I went, oh, okay. Look, I've worked with volunteer groups, professional emergency service groups all my life, and what we do as paramedics is we build teams. So I said, that's fine, we can we'll build the team and we'll get on with it. So we arrived at the scene and had a look at the truck, and I agreed, this truck was past 45 degrees. It was on the side of a cliff, and if it had rolled, it all the recovery was going to be done from the leeward side. So if it rolled over, it was going to roll on top of it where we're going to be doing the rescue. And I agree with the assessment of the paramedics. But there was one volunteer there who was very vocal and very, very outspoken. And he suggested, we get some cranes and lift the truck back up onto the road and do the rescue. So after we had a look, I got all the team leaders. There was multiple agencies there. I got all the team leaders together. We had a discussion. We basically all agreed it wasn't safe. But there was this one person. And, he was very vocal, made lots of suggestions, and, it got to the point where I had to speak to his commander and said, you need to bring this guy in to check. He goes, he doesn't listen to me. And what I should have done that moment is I should have removed him, but I didn't. I left him there, and he continued to cause problems the entire case.
This is the beauty of hindsight, though, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And, look, I worked for ambulance in Victoria. As I said, it was a very political time. Doctors were trying very hard to get on the helicopters. Air ambulance has a tendency of trying to micromanage the big jobs. And so as soon as I got involved and I could see this was going to be very protracted and very difficult, I gave my personal phone over to our pilot. I gave all my comms stuff to my pilot. And, we had a structure there. We had a scene commander, and I said all the communication needs to go through him as per channel. And I didn't realize this, but after I finished the job, I had 15 missed calls from Air Ambulance in Victoria. They wanted to talk to me. I didn't know there was politicking going on back at Essendon. The doctors wanted to come and take over. There was that sort of stuff going on, and in the background, we were going along, and we'd been going for quite a few hours, and I was getting concerned that we were making no headway on recovering this patient's leg. He was sitting there. He was essentially well, apart from his leg being buried into the wreckage of the truck. And probably, I think, maybe 3 or 4 hours in, I thought we needed to have a discussion about getting a surgeon to the scene. I still thought we would get him out. So the scene commander and I had a discussion. We had multiple teams working to do the rescue. Nothing was working. And I thought we'd better off to get someone to the scene now rather than wait. So I went through the doctor's side of it. It's Adult Retrieval Victoria, which is the doctor arm of Ambulance Victoria, which was against the flow. We should have gone through another department, which I don't really care about that. We got a surgeon to the scene, which is ultimately what we needed. So they arranged from Kate Martin, who's probably one of the leading trauma surgeons in Victoria. She was flown to the scene, but she didn't come with another flight paramedic. She came on the the police helicopter with a doctor and not a flight paramedic. And, you know, I'd been working in this truck performing the rescue. We had some issues with some of the people at the scene. We had a couple of very near misses with one of the volunteer organisations doing the rescue. We had to get a safety officer in just to maintain the safety of the patient and the safety of us doing the work.
Wow.
It was a very complex rescue, and you know, we just got to this point where we'd been going for 6 or 7 hours and we'd made absolutely no inroad.
Yeah.
We were no closer getting that leg out than when we started.
Do you feel like you had any alternatives at that point?
We had we tried about 10 different plans. We had three teams trying to come in from different angles.
Wow.
I could feel below the wreckage of the car, around the motor, the block of the engine of the truck, and the leg was snapped, and it was at 90 degrees. It was partially amputated. And, you know, look, the colour of the skin suggested there was a lack of perfusion distally to the wound. So I was of the opinion that it would be likely that the limb wouldn't have survived regardless. I had to get involved with the technical rescue because the emergency services that were there it wasn't working well. And so I had an intensive care paramedic. I put him in charge of the clinical management of the patient, and I got heavily involved in the technical rescue. I've done urban search and rescue, so I'm familiar with all the stuff. And I got a volunteer working with me who was a legend, and we had a great synergy, and we were working together, but we broke all the tools, the cutting gear, we fractured all the blades, the wooden cart, and we were just getting nowhere. So when the surgeon arrived, and it was a registrar on the helicopter as well from Adult Retrieval Victoria. As I said, I was disappointed that another Micro Flight paramedic didn't come out to give us a hand. I was exhausted. I hadn't stopped for all that time. I hadn't had anything to eat or drink. I hadn't been to the toilet. I hadn't been out of the truck. And it was so precarious. I was just black and blue for being in this spot. But, you know, we had a discussion, and I showed everyone. All the people that were there had looked and said, has anyone got any ideas? We were taking advice from the tow truck driver about options. But wow. we had this one guy who was down the bottom saying, you know, get two cranes, lift the truck up off onto the road and do the rescue there. And no, I said to him, I said, look, mate, we can't do that, because I think that if we try and winch the truck away, there is a risk we would kill the patient. And rule 101, as we know, is do no harm.
Yep.
But he was disgruntled and unhappy with that idea, and eventually, you know, everyone was exhausted, and his workers turned on him and told him to be quiet. Anyway, so we sat up, and the surgeon and the registrar agreed it didn't appear to be any other way. The surgeon had a look at the limb, and we anaesthetised the person in the truck. We used ladders. We were 30 feet off the ground when we put him to sleep. And she got in, and basically all she did was she put a cutting wire into the partial amputation and just finished the amputation. And so, you know, we got the guy out and flew him to Melbourne. I'm not actually sure how long it was, maybe 6 hours or 7 hours, I think we were there for. And we arrived at the hospital, and one of the doctors who works for Adult Retrieval in Victoria was had met us at the Alfred. He worked at the Alfred, and as we walked in, he met me and said, "Why were you in such a hurry to cut this man's leg off?"
Wow!
And I was just so taken back by that comment.
It's fairly confrontational.
I don't think he meant it to be. To be fair to him, I think he's a little bit autistic and so forth. But it stung me. It really did, Sonny. I was really taken back. My interior chest, abdomen and arms were just covered in lacerations and bruises from working in this really tiny confines of this truck. And it's funny, you know, I was shocked by that, and, you know, we sort of went off and did our own things, and the very next day I got a phone call from just some HR person and said, "Hey, what are you doing at the moment?" I said, "Oh, I'm about to go to night shift." And I said, "Oh, we don't want you to go to night shift. We want you to go and meet with the ambulance service solicitors."
Wow.
And I said, "Well, why would I be doing that?" And they said, "Oh, because we've had a phone call from the Alfred Hospital saying that the man's leg has arrived and it's perfectly intact. You've cut off a perfectly intact leg."
Earlier you'd mentioned that it was looking fairly poorly perfused, and
it was.
Right. Okay.
So I was just, I was devastated, I start going, "Well, his leg's perfect. How could that be?"
This started some internal conflict where you start questioning your own sanity.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
So
has anyone at this point, I'm just curious. Has anyone at this point asked you how you're going?
No.
Right. We're 24 hours plus now.
I had some support from my friendship group, my peers. But no one from ambulance had even asked me what had happened. So the next day I had to front up to the ambulance service solicitors to prepare for litigation. And
This is the day after.
The day after.
Okay, all right. I'm just processing this in my own head.
Yeah, I still trouble to process it too. So, but then the following day to that, ambulance got another phone call from the Alfred Hospital saying, "Sorry, it was the wrong leg. Another patient had his leg amputated and that turned up, and your leg was actually quite badly damaged."
Wow.
So, I suppose most hospitals have like 6 or 7 legs turn up a day from amputations. This was absolutely, in my mind, nothing but politics about getting doctors on helicopters, that whole action. And I think it's a terribly sad thing to do to someone.
I mean, we're looking at a clinically complex case, an organisationally complex case, a politically complex case. That's also filled with, several personalities, some we may call egos. This is almost like the perfect storm when you're in the middle of it.
Yeah, look, and it gets worse. I a couple of days later, I get a phone call saying that the disgruntled emergency services worker has written letters to the CEO of ambulance, fire, the police, the premier, the health minister, and said that because of my actions and my arrogance, this man had his leg cut off unnecessarily, and if I had listened to him, and I quote, "this man would be kicking the footy round with his children today."
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Is this someone with clinical competency, or is this someone from a non-clinical?
No, he was an emergency service worker.
Yep, okay.
From a volunteer. But I believe he had some professional experience in an organisation as an emergency service worker, but non-medical side. So,
had they listened to him?
Beg your pardon?
Did they listen to his concerns or?
Well, obviously they did, because I was put into all these reviews. And how ambulance services work, if anyone complains about anything, you will go through a review process. And I've got no qualms about review. I was called to go into a review to have a discussion around the fact that I hadn't followed procedure and that we went outside of the chain of command by not going through our emergency management unit, which I accepted was my mistake. We needed a surgeon flown to the scene. We got one. We probably got one of the best ones in Victoria. How that happens, I don't think is that important. But the manager of that unit was going around quite openly saying that if he'd gone to the job, he would have got the leg out. The thing that is distressing to me about all this, and I listened to multiple people tell me that this senior manager was going around criticising me, saying that, if he'd been there, he would have got it out. And I had a couple of other people say the same thing. I have never told the story to any of those people, and even to this day. They don't know what happened. They don't know my side of it. They just form their own judgment. And the multi-agency debrief that did take place over this case, I was not invited to attend. And that decision was made on the basis that I had all these complaints against me from various parties, so I had to go through the review.
How does that prevent you from attending the debrief?
I don't know.
That still makes no sense to me, but you're right, it did get worse. My jaw is metaphorically on the ground right now, Darren, because as a paramedic, we do need to work in extraordinarily dynamic environments. But we only can achieve so much what we achieve because of the support we get from our organisations and from the people who are there. But it sounds like this was everything but that.
It really was. I was so it was so upsetting. I'm a very loyal person at Ambulance Victoria. I wear the uniform with pride. I try and be a good representative of it. You know, you won't hear me bagging the organisation like a lot of AMBOs do. I love it. And, you know, I think to think that I've been a loyal employee, I've tried to be a good paramedic. I haven't always got it right. And I'm happy. The thing that, again, I keep coming back to this point, I would be happy for people to sit down. If I went and said, here's the presentation, and we had a photographer from a newspaper there, and that person gave me 400 images of this truck accident over 6 hours or whatever it was. Here's the 400 photos. Here's what we were dealing with. Here's the complexity. This is what happened. If I told the story, and if I shared that story with you now and all the photographs, and we went through it and you said, you know what, I don't know that you did the right thing, I'm happy for you to have that opinion in the fact that you've been informed. But where I struggled with this whole thing was that people were judging me and condemning me without me sharing the story. I mean, I just think that's so unfair.
Yeah, it's this Monday morning quarterback mentality of people are so quick to have their own opinion of whether or not you performed and if it was right or if it was wrong. And, you know, should we rather be looking and going, well, with the information that you had and the situation that you're in, like, is what you did reasonable? You know, there's different ways to skin a cat.
Yeah, look, and, you know, the really sad thing was that I mentioned this in the book. I think I've sanitized it a lot because it, you know, I obviously didn't want to offend anyone and upset people. I have sanitized it down. The manager that caused me a lot of the grief in this is now, he got terminated for some misconduct. So I'm not fearful of him, and he was a very powerful political person in Ambulance Victoria. Mm. But, you know, again, the book goes out, and maybe 12 months after I put the book out, I get this distressed phone call from Kate Martin, the surgeon who came to the scene, and she said, no one's come to me and asked me my opinion. I'm the person who cut the leg off.
Wow.
And she said, you know, and there's all these reviews that have been done on the case. She goes, no one's asked me. She said, the leg was stuffed. It was so close to being fully amputated, it wasn't funny. She goes, there's no saving that leg ever.
You've essentially suffered a trial by media without being in the media, haven't you? Like it's an amazing concept that so many people can form so many opinions without actually talking to the people. And this is what surprises me about you being even removed from the debrief. I just think you're one of the most important witnesses to actually describe what had happened, and yet you were removed from it. It's interesting hearing this, Darren. I mean, you know, the gravity and the level of what you've experienced, certainly it supersedes anything I have professionally. But, you know, when we first spoke about even recording this podcast, we knew it would be controversial. We knew it would be quite personal. It would be quite emotional. But it's also so important because, you know, some of this experience that you've been describing, it's not isolated, unfortunately. And both Nick and I, through our own ambulance and paramedic careers, have suffered these similar situations where you've been thrown under the bus by colleagues, you've been thrown under the bus by a service or a company you work for without anyone actually attempting to find out, you know, what actually happened. And I guess my question, I mean, you've lived and breathed this traumatically for so long. What needs to improve? How do we change this? Because part of the reason that we even developed the shift extension was to plug a gap in paramedic development and, you know, get some things published, get some people talking, and just develop a bit more collegiality between, you know, the profession. But how can we improve things. What's missing in this story for you?
You know, look, I just spent a few months working in our patient review area, and, you know, I was initially involved when we set up our clinical governance a long, long time ago, and, you know, clinical review was it was very controversial and topical, and it remains so today. But I'm very pleased to say that the people that we've had running our patient review department are very, very ambulance advocates in terms of looking after our staff. And, you know, I think things like when you do reviews, taking the time to speak to people before you form judgments, I still think in Ambulance Victoria there's this mindset that if you're a junior up-and-coming manager that you have to be seen to be taking a scalp. I think that's it's a terribly troubling situation. I think that for the junior managers that are coming up and, you know, you put your staff into risk, man, as we should do, and you go through, the first thing that you should do before you do that is speak to the staff and get an idea of what's happened, try and understand their perspective. I think we need to be kind to each other. We just have this, certainly in Ambulance Victoria, we have on occasion we put people to the sword, and, you know, I just don't understand why at times. You know, but as I said, I think what I loved seeing when I worked in patient review, when I was there as a patient review specialist, was the ability before you started forming your judgments to ring the people and have a conversation and see the side of it, and then you go back to the team managers and have a discussion with those. And, you know, from my point of view, there's a number of occasions where I thought, geez, the manager wants to put the staff to the sword here. But as soon as you get their perspective and you listen to the story, a few of those turned into commendations. And, you know, I could go and have a conversation with the team managers, and I guess, you know, given my seniority in the organisation, you could chat to them and try and understand where they were coming from, but then you perform some education around support and guidance. And, you know, I was really pleased in that role where I, as I said, I had a couple of cases where the team manager's language was really strong, and I thought, gee whiz, what's happening here? And, you know, by chatting to the AMOs, then chatting to the managers, we were able to turn that around into something that resulted in a commendation for the crew because they'd done an amazing job. So I think there's open and transparency in doing our reviews. People should be entitled to see what the review is, what's said, who's saying what, whose opinions what, where the biases are. Be kind to each other is something that we still need to do. We're very quick to criticise each other.
You know, that's an interesting statement there, even Darren, because Nick and I were discussing, you know, we both started our careers at roughly the same time. And certainly in the earlier part of our careers, criticism was certainly above critique.
Yeah.
But we're seeing a really good transition in the paramedic profession. You know, I mean, this is back in the paramedic practice days in Australia. Now, we're seeing a really good transition to a lot more reflective critiques of situations and a lot more questioning, which is why these discussions with people like you are so valuable, because you've not only had to, you know, survive something like this, but you're the change maker who's now essentially a paramedic advocate. And I can hear some amazing positive outcomes that you're bringing to the table that are only going to develop paramedics and therefore our profession in the future. So I think that's a huge step for us, but I think there's still a lot of work to be done.
I agree, Tony. And, you know, look, we've all been around a long time, and how many times do we hear a story and someone will say, did you hear about the job with blah, blah, and you sit there and go, oh, my God, that sounds terrible.
Hey, Nick, did we have one of those today?
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, Nick and I were breaking down a case study that we were presented with by someone who had been there, and there was a lot of room for improvement. But we tried to, I guess, really emphasize we're not there to criticize the people there, because we weren't. Mm-hmm. We didn't see the dynamic factors. We didn't experience the sight, smells and sounds. But when we explore it unemotively and objectively, there are ways to improve. And if we can do that professionally, not only people like Nick and I and everyone that was in the discussion is going to improve, but we're going to be able to essentially critique and criticise each other constructively.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, as we mature as a profession, we'll be able to, you know, reflect back on cases, and, you know, mistakes are going to happen. We can't expect that we're going to be perfect all the time. We're going to make errors, but, you know, we don't want to see those errors as a judgment of the character of that individual or their abilities, but as an opportunity for them to grow as a clinician and be better next time. It's how we respond to the case after it happens really dictates the trajectory for that clinician and the team.
I think that's such an important statement, Nick. Sitting in and listening to some ISO ones, and no paramedic gets up in the morning to go to work and goes, "I'm going to hurt someone today," or "I'm going to be involved in a death." But it does happen, and we do get it wrong. We do make mistakes. But sitting in an ISR one, and what I love about the way that we're doing at the moment, the paramedics are de-identified. We talk about the people, so that the emotive side of it goes out. And if you're just talking about the incident, and you might talk about paramedic A had 5 years' experience, he was this far into his shift. We talk about all those factors that may contribute to the bad outcome. But as clinicians, I think the expectation on all paramedics is you go to work and you do everything right all the time. That's not real. So transfer that across to being a practitioner is that when you go to a job and it goes wrong, you've got to be put your hand up and say it's gone wrong. I'm not blame others. I'm not blame this or blame that. So, as a person who's done those investigations, if I walk up to you and you can say, "Hey, what happened here?" and you go, "You know what, Darren, I didn't put the monitor on. I should have put the monitor on," and there's a delay to defibrillation as a result. The review's done because you've acknowledged the error. You talk about your practice and how you evolve it so that doesn't happen again. The review is finished. When you go to speak to paramedics and sit down and say, so what went wrong here, and said, "Oh, look, I was working with Nick and Nick wouldn't do this and Nick wouldn't do that, and I think it's Nick's fault, and but hang on, you're the attending paramedic, yeah, but Nick said this and Nick said that, and I don't really think it's my fault, it's all Nick's fault." Those reviews don't go well, so I think as a profession we need to be more mature and accepting when we make mistakes.
Yeah. Interestingly, I see a lot of hierarchical problems in the profession still. But I've got to keep reminding people, and myself included, experience does not equate to competence in certain areas. And, all of us have good days and bad days. And I think, the more that we can shed some of that that egotistical arrogance and accept, everyone knows something I don't, the better we're going to become. Because like you said, it's a huge step for someone to admit an error. But it's also such a powerful developmental tool if we actually learn to do that appropriately. Yeah. And I think that's the experience that we need in people.
Well, I think that, if you think back to your time when you spoke to your mentors when you've made a mistake, for me, one of the most powerful things that I learned, and I think it's made me a better mentor and a better teacher, is, I was involved in, if I didn't kill the patient, I certainly accelerated their death. And I made a series of shortcuts and some bad decisions, and I was just so devastated by this terrible error. And, I went to my most respected mentor and I was telling him about it, and then he told me about a case where he'd made a similar type level of error. And I think, and for me, that I thought, well, here's a guy I've got on a pedestal and I can look at him and say, okay, you made this error and you're still around, you're still going okay, you're still respected. Maybe it's okay if I make one. And, I think podcasts and what you guys are doing here, when we have people that are senior in their organisation sharing their experiences and particularly those experiences where they've made errors, I'm not going to say it normalises error, but I think it allows people to acknowledge that they can own up to a mistake. If people like Sonny can tell them a story about how he got it wrong.
Unfortunately, I've got a few of those stories in my book, so it's probably best not to read it. Hey, back to the book though. So both Nick and I have read the book.
And fantastic.
Wow. Amazing. From a paramedic's perspective, it was absolutely amazing to read, and it was so valuable to have those experiences and those stories to even reflect on, our own practice. Nick and I have spent, several days in the classroom or went to students talking about some of those. You raised the reasons why you wrote, but one of the things you also said at the very beginning of this podcast, Darren, was you actually found it somewhat cathartic. Now, that struck a chord with me because people have asked me why I've written, and I'm still writing today, and it has been, for me, part of my professional journey. I found it an extraordinary reflective tool to be able to actually process some of the things that I've experienced, whether they be clinical errors, whether they be being thrown under the bus, not as dramatically as you, but still not pleasant nonetheless. But I have also found it extraordinarily cathartic. And this was also one of the things that, you know, when Sandy, Nick and I, Andy, were talking about developing something like a shift extension, you know, we were talking about there's no home for paramedics to develop these skills. You either have them or you don't. You're either academic or you're not. And so we were hoping that we could bridge that gap. Writing the book, did you find that a reflective tool? Was it something that helped you build essentially your resilience to the adversity that you suffered?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I wrote about the – I was off work and I wrote about the amputation job in its entirety. I thought I was never coming back to work. I thought I was finished. I thought I'm going to end up in a psych ward somewhere sucking my thumb. I thought I was absolutely gone. And that was, you know, a part of the journey to get back. I was only off work for a very short space of time in reality, but it was one of the tools. And, you know, like you, Sonny, I still journal. And when I speak to, I'm very fortunate I get asked to speak to some student groups. I love doing it. And I always talk about a little bit of a mental health thing. And, you know, one of the things that I recommend is that they journal as well, because that self-reflection, as you say, and if nothing else, being a paramedic can be a pretty amazing job. And just imagine, you know, I'm closer to ending my career now, but imagine my children's children being able to read the stories about Dad. That was perhaps a motivator as well. But, you know, I strongly advocate for, you know, journaling. But, again, we all know this. It's not a one-size-fits-all. What works for you doesn't necessarily work for me. So for some people it works, for some people it doesn't.
If nothing, writing the book actually improved my spelling and grammar.
Well, I'm pretty close to being...
I know, mate. It's not very good.
No, I said it improved it. I said it wasn't great.
Well, to tell you a story, guys, my publishing experience was not a particularly pleasant one. And one of the things that happened is that I paid to have my book error-proofed, as you would know, Sonny, and the error-proof version never got sent to the publisher. I sent the... Well, not my... My agent sent the version that I sent to the error proofer. So the 58 spelling mistakes that are still in the book.
I've got 16 in mind. So.
Yeah. People contact me all the time and say, do you realise you've used this word in the wrong context? And I go, yes, you're the 13th person to tell me. Thank you.
Anyway. It means the more people have bought the book, it's all good.
Yeah.
Well, Darren, it's an absolutely fantastic book, mate. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. And to be brutally honest, hand on my heart, it made me re-fall in love with being a paramedic. Well done. The book's called Life on the Line. And where can our listeners get a copy from?
The best place is to go to Amazon.
Amazon?
Yeah.
Awesome. It was good to see some familiar names in there, Nick Roeder and Peter Davidson.
Yeah, Chuck Davidson.
Yeah, amazing. Great stories.
Yeah, very lucky, Nick. I've been surrounded by amazing people and, you know, I'm coming to the end of the career. I've had an amazing, amazing career, and it's largely been by, you know, being surrounded by good people. You know, it's an interesting thing for you guys. I'm going off a little bit off cue here, but I listen to a lot of your – well, I've listened to all your podcasts that you guys have done, and, you know – there's a couple of interesting themes that I took away. I listened to the one on Alex the other day. First of all, how does a person become an industry leader in ambulance with not actually ever being a paramedic? That young lady.
I know. Unbelievable.
Isn't she amazing?
If you were in charge of recruitment in an organisation, you would be offering her a job, getting her a position, and then offering her anything she wanted, because she's a go-getter. There's no question.
100%.
But one of the other take-home points that I listen to you guys' podcast is the need that people like you guys, and I think I would say I'm in the same boat, the need to give back. A lot of people you have on your podcast have that need. The reason they put themselves out because they want to give back to the organisation. And as I come to the end of my career, I'm getting closer and closer, I really want to think of some way in which I can connect, particularly to our young people, how I can help them, how I can... maybe stop and making some of the silly mistakes that I made. I don't know, but it's a lovely thing you guys have done with the podcast. So well done.
Appreciate it.
I really appreciate it, Darren.
We're always open to feedback, aren't we, Nick?
100%, mate.
We critique and criticise each other daily.
He's got a whiteboard yet?
I don't have one. You can see I'm next to the shed.
Yeah, is it still in the cupboard?
We should get one.
That's for Nick. Nick,
maybe in 12 months we'll upgrade to a whiteboard. Usually it's a serviette and a pencil.
Yeah.
That's a great plan.
You guys something with a whiteboard.
Well, Darren, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it, mate. For all our listeners, please go and get a copy of Life on the Line. Have a read. It's an amazing book. And if you have any questions, qualms, queries, or concerns, reach out to us. You could find us on social media. We'll see you next time. Thanks, Steve, for coming on again.
Thank you, Nick and Darren. That's amazing. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.